rectifying himself and telling his wife where he is.
Presumably you have inquired into this. I was under the impression that we have detained a number of Americans who work for the Dole plantation. Was there a Dole employee named Fertig?
I have inquired, sir, and the inquiries are continuing. We have fairly complete personnel records. The name Fertig does not appear on any of them, which brings us to the General's very perceptive theory about a nom de guerre. Fertig is a German word meaning finished or the end, something like that. What we very well may have here is a Dole executive, either from here or one of the other Dole operations in the Philippines, who has assumed the name Fertig and has undertaken to harass us by announcing that he is a general.
The general is not above reacting to flattery. He liked that very perceptive theory comment.
That seems a possibility, General Kurokawa said. But I would not recommend that we dismiss the possibility that the Americans have either left behind someone military, to cause us trouble, or sent someone in.
No such conclusion has been drawn, General, Saikaku said.
What about the radio station? Where is it?
Somewhere in the mountains, sir, Saikaku replied. I have learned from Lieutenant Hideyori that location of a radio transmitter is not quite as simple as the signals people would have us believe.
Explain that, please, General Kurokawa ordered.
I defer to Lieutenant Hideyori's expertise, sir, Saikaku said, and waved his hand at the signals lieutenant. Hideyori jumped to his feet, came to attention, and bowed to General Kurokawa.
Sir, the enemy transmitter is in the mountains. The triangulation location technique requires 2, preferably 3, truck-mounted directional radio antennae. When a signal is detected, the operators rotate the antennae using a signal strength meter. That indicates the direction of the transmitting antenna. A line is drawn on a map from the truck antenna in the direction of the transmitting antenna. Each truck does this. Where the lines converge on a map, one expects to find the transmitter.
Yes?
In the mountains, sir, it is very difficult to adjust the directional antennae, and the imprecision of the adjustment is magnified by distance. There are very few roads in the mountains which will take our trucks. The distance is great.
In other words, Lieutenant, you have not been able to locate the transmitter by triangulation.
Yes, sir. Sir, another problem is that the transmitter is operating only infrequently, not, as in the beginning, every hour on the hour.
Find this radio station, Lieutenant,
General Kurokawa ordered, shutting him off. Hideyori came to attention again, bowed again, and sat down.
Has there been other communication between this radio station and the United States?
They are not in communication with the Americans in Australia, sir, Saikaku said.
Yes, sir. They have sent out the names of several of their officers. If they have several officers, wouldn't that suggest to you that this is not just one pineapple company employee harassing us?
General Kurokawa asked sarcastically.
Sir, we have checked the names against captured records. As you are aware, we do not have personnel rosters before the surrender. The Americans burned those. We have only rosters of personnel who entered captivity. Some of those subsequently escaped. None of the names of the escaped prisoners matched those sent by this radio station. It is entirely possible that this man Fertig is transmitting names he has made up for purposes of deception, and there have been no incidents of anything that might be construed as an attack against our forces. I do not believe, he concluded, that there is an irregular force, just this man annoying us.
I devoutly hope you are right, Captain Saikaku, General Kurokawa said. Thank you all for coming to see me.
2. Naval Air Transport Command Passenger Terminal, United States Naval Base, Pearl Harbor, Oahu, Territory of Hawaii. 0625 hours, 16 October, 1942. In his own mind, Brigadier General Fleming W. Pickering, USMCR, tended to see himself primarily as a reasonably competent ship's master and businessman. In civilian life, he had been the chairman of the board of the Pacific and Far East Shipping Corporation, dragged by force of circumstances into situations very little connected with his experience in either commanding a ship or running a Fortune 500 corporation. Shortly after the start of the war, like many other top-level corporate executives, he was offered a position at the newly formed Office of Strategic Services. When he arrived in Washington, he found the position offered was not only second level, but would leave him immediately subordinate to a man for whom he had virtually no respect. He furthermore believed this action was less an evaluation of his potential value to the OSS than a gratuitously insulting payback from Colonel William Donovan, head of the OSS. Donovan was a Wall Street lawyer with whom he had had several acrimonious business dealings. He declined the position in another acrimonious meeting with Donovan and then volunteered his services to the United States Marine Corps. Despite the Distinguished Service Cross he had earned in the trenches in France in World War I, the Marines had no place for him either. About to return to his San Francisco office, he had a chance meeting with Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox in the hotel suite of their mutual close friend, Senator Richardson K. Fowler. Over more than a couple of drinks, he suggested to Knox that after the unmitigated disaster at Pearl Harbor, the decent thing for him to do was resign. That unabashed candor and Pickering's reputation in the upper echelons of the American business community were enough to make Knox realize that Pickering was just the man he needed to be his eyes and ears in the Pacific. If he himself did not intimidate Pickering, Knox concluded, and if Wild Bill Donovan didn't either, no admiral in the Pacific was likely to daunt him, nor, for that matter, was General Douglas MacArthur. Knox's character assessment had proved valid. On his initial trip to the Pacific, Knox had arranged for him to be commissioned as a Navy captain. Pickering prepared clear-eyed reports detailing how bad the situation really was. These often differed significantly from the reports Knox had been getting from the admirals at SINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Headquarters, which confirmed Knox's fears that he was being told only what the admirals wished him to hear. In addition, Pickering somehow established a strong personal relationship with General Douglas MacArthur. This, in Knox's view, was extraordinary, for MacArthur was not only a notorious loner, but he was surrounded by a group of senior officers, the Bataan Gang, who had served with him in the Philippines and regarded it as their duty to keep their supreme commander isolated from outsiders. Knox's pleasure with his selection of Pickering turned out to be short-lived, however. Without any authorization, Pickering sailed with the invasion fleet to Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands. Shortly after the invasion, there was a message from him expressing, in precise detail, his dissatisfaction with the Navy's role in the invasion. He then further manifested his displeasure by going ashore. Once there, he placed himself at the service of Major General Alexander Archer Vandegrift, the commander of the 1st Marine Division, and somewhat melodramatically volunteered to perform any duties he might be assigned, if only those of a rifleman. Inasmuch as the Navy assault fleet had sailed away, leaving the Marines alone on their beachhead, the source of Pickering's contempt, Vandegrift was not able to order the first Navy captain he had ever seen in Marine Corps utilities and carrying a Springfield rifle back aboard a ship with his polite thanks. Shortly afterward, the 1st Marine Division G2 was killed in combat. By that time, Pickering had so impressed Vandegrift with his intelligence and competence that Vandegrift, short of senior officers, appointed him acting G2 until a trained replacement could be sent to the island. After a month, Pickering reluctantly left Guadalcanal, and then only on the direct orders of Secretary Knox, who had ordered the captain of a Navy destroyer making an emergency supply run to Guadalcanal not to leave unless he had Pickering safely aboard. En route to Espiritu Santo, from where Pickering was to be flown to the United States, the destroyer was attacked by a Japanese bomber and her captain killed. Although seriously wounded himself, Pickering assumed command of the destroyer. Not because he was the senior naval officer aboard, but because he believed himself to be the best qualified mariner aboard. with some justification. He had been licensed as a master mariner, any tonnage, any ocean, at 26. Pickering's exploits, meanwhile, came to the attention of President Roosevelt, not only through Secretary Knox, but also through the Commander-in-Chief Pacific, who wanted him decorated for his behavior aboard the destroyer, and through Senator Richardson K. Fowler, Republican, California, Pickering's lifelong friend and the man the President described privately as the leader of my none-too-loyal opposition. Roosevelt saw in Pickering the same qualities Knox did. Moreover, he felt a certain personal kinship with him, despite their political differences. Both had sons serving in combat in the Marine Corps. Thus, he overrode the strong, if politely expressed, objections of the Marine Corps establishment and commissioned Pickering a Brigadier General, USMC Reserve. Shortly after that, he was named Chief, USMC Office of Management Analysis. This was done, at Secretary Knox's suggestion, primarily because it gave Management Analysis a general officer, essential in the waging of bureaucratic wars in Washington. It also gave him a billet on USMC manning charts. At the same time, it was presumed that Pickering would permit Colonel F. L. Rickaby, a career intelligence officer and the previous chief, to run things as they had been run. This was an error in judgment. Having been placed in charge, Pickering assumed command. To everyone's surprise, Rickaby was not outraged. In fact, he seemed delighted with Pickering's leadership. This proved true even after Pickering ignored all advice and ordered, from his hospital bed, the evacuation of two Marines operating a coastwatcher station on the Japanese-held island of Buka, who were in imminent danger of death, either from Japanese action or starvation. The operation was successfully completed before formal objections to it could work their way through the military hierarchy.
"I have something to say," Brigadier General Pickering said softly. Pickering was in his early 40s, tall, distinguished-looking, and he wore a superbly tailored uniform, the breast of which displayed an impressive array of colored ribbons, attesting to his valor both in World War I and the current conflict. Four Marines turned to look at him. Major Homer C. Jake Dillon, USMCR, a stocky, crew-cutted man in his middle 30s, First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, a well-built, lithe, even-featured young man in his early 20s, Sergeant George F. Hart, USMC, a 24-year-old with the build of a circus strongman, and Corporal Robert F. Easterbrook, who weighed 132 pounds, was 19 years old, and looked younger.
"I want to say thank you," General Pickering said, "to you three." He indicated the major, the lieutenant, and the sergeant, "for the Buka operation. You carried it off without a hitch. It couldn't have been done without you. You're a credit to the Corps."
"Yeah, we know, Flim," Major Dillon replied. "You really didn't have to get out of bed at this time of the morning to tell us."
Majors do not normally address general officers by their first names, nor mock them, no matter how softly. But the relationship between these two was a bit out of the ordinary. Before they had donned Marine uniforms for the second times in their lives, Jake Dillon, Vice President, Publicity, Metro Magnum Studios, and Fleming Pickering had been friends. Pickering shook his head in tolerant resignation, not indignation.
"Shut up, Jake," he said. "I'm serious about this."
"You're embarrassing the killer,"
Dillon said, unrepentant, nodding at Lieutenant McCoy.
"The next thing you know, he'll be blushing."
"Fuck you, Jake,"
Lieutenant McCoy snapped unpleasantly. "You never know when to stop, do you, Jake?" General Pickering said. "You know he hates to be called killer."
"Flem, you gave us a job to do. We did it. Leave it at that."
"No, I won't," Pickering said. "As soon as I can find somebody who knows how to fill out the forms, I'm going to do my level best to see that you're all decorated."
"With respect, sir," McCoy said. "Howard and Koffler deserve a medal, not us."
"The way things are run in the Marine Corps, Lieutenant, generals make decisions like that," Pickering said.
"Yes, sir."
A loudspeaker went off, harshly but audibly ordering all passengers for the San Diego flight to proceed to the motor whaleboat for boarding of the aircraft. "Have a nice flight," General Pickering said. "And whether you like it or not, you have my gratitude and my admiration." He shook hands with McCoy first, and then Dillon, and then he turned to the boyish corporal. "Easterbrook, you did one hell of a job on Guadalcanal," he said. "Your pictures are probably going to influence this war in ways you can't imagine. I've told Major Dillon, Jake, listen to me, to make sure the proper people know what you did and how well you did it." Corporal Easterbrook blushed. Finally, Pickering turned to Sergeant Hart. "It's not too late to change your mind, George," he said. "You still have a priority to get on that airplane, and you certainly deserve a couple of weeks off."
"No, sir, I'll go to Australia with you, sir."
"Try not to fall out of the whaleboat, Jake," General Pickering said, and turned and walked out of the passenger lounge.
"Hart's the one who falls out of boats, General," Dillon called after him.
A 1939 Cadillac Fleetwood with civilian license plates was parked outside the building. Pickering got behind the wheel, started the engine, waited for Sergeant Hart to get in, and then drove off. 500 yards down the road, he made a sudden U-turn and headed back to the passenger terminal.
"You never know those damn things are airborne until they're airborne," he said. "Let's wait and see if they really get off."
"Yes, sir,"
Sergeant Hart said. Pickering had several reasons for coming to the Navy base to see the four off. One of them was that he feared that the Navy would ignore their 5A travel priority and give their seats on the plane to some deserving, read, high-ranking, Navy officer. They couldn't do so officially, of course, but in the minds of most people in the Navy, any Marine, not just a lowly corporal, was of far less importance than a fellow sailor with the four stripes of a captain or the solid gold stripes of an admiral on his tunic sleeves. There was far less chance that a mistake or an unfortunate misunderstanding would occur, leaving an admiral sitting in the seat reserved for Corporal Easterbrook when the plane took off, if the Navy was aware that he was being seen off by a Marine general. Oddly enough, in Pickering's mind, the boyish corporal had the greatest justification for a priority seat to Washington. It was entirely possible that the Secretary of the Navy, for that matter, the President himself, would want to talk to him. The day before, Major Edward Banning, USMC, had carried still and motion picture films Easterbrook had shot on Guadalcanal to the States. By now, Banning was either in Washington or soon would be. On his arrival, he would brief Secretary Knox and, Pickering believed, the President and his Chief of Staff, Admiral William Leahy, as well. A picture was indeed worth a thousand words, and Easterbrook's film showed the situation as it was far better than any thick report could possibly show it. It was impossible to get more than one seat on yesterday's plane, and Pickering decided it had to go to Banning. Easterbrook obviously was not equipped to handle a briefing. But there would be questions asked today about specific details of the photographs or 16mm film, if not by Roosevelt, Knox, or Leahy, then certainly by Major General Horace W. T. Forrest, the intelligence officer on the staff of the Commandant of the Marine Corps, by Colonel F. L. Rickaby of the USMC Office of Management Analysis, and by others. These questions could only be answered by the photographer himself, or possibly by Jake Dillon. On the other hand, there was no real reason why Lieutenant McCoy had to be rushed to Washington. The polite fiction was that he would be useful in helping Dillon and Easterbrook. But the real reason he was going was that Pickering had decided McCoy had a moral right to a seat on the plane. McCoy and Hart had paddled ashore from a submarine onto the enemy-held island of Buka, carrying with them a desperately needed radio and some other supplies for a Coast Watcher team that was supplying information concerning Japanese sea and air movements critical for the Battle of Guadalcanal. The fact that he had accomplished this mission, which included bringing out with him the two Marine Coast Watchers, without firing a shot, in no way diminished the enormous risk he had voluntarily taken. While planning the operation, Pickering had privately decided that the operation had one chance in four of succeeding. In Pickering's mind, if there were 40 passengers aboard the huge four-engine consolidated PB2Y3 Coronado, it was mathematically certain that perhaps 10% of them, four, were brass hats whose rank, not legitimate importance to the war effort, had gotten them a seat. One of the four could wait a day before going home. Pickering stopped the Cadillac on a wharf from which much of the carnage the Japanese had caused on Battleship Row on December 7, 1941, could be seen, and got from behind the wheel. Hart followed him to the edge of the pier. As they saw the whaleboats, three of them approached the huge seaplane. A Navy officer, a lieutenant junior grade, wearing canvas puttees, a steel helmet, and a .45 pistol suspended from a pistol belt, came trotting down the pier.
"We are obviously parked where we are not supposed to park, and driving a civilian car where there are supposed to be no civilian cars," Sergeant Hart thought.
The J.G. slowed when he saw the stars on Pickering's epaulettes and collar points. He saluted.
May I help the general, sir?
"No, thank you," Pickering said, and gestured over the water. "We're just watching to see if the Coronado gets off."
"General, this is a restricted area. There's not supposed to be any civilian vehicles in this area, sir."
"Is that so?" Pickering replied. "Well, we won't be long, son." Hart managed to keep his face straight as he watched the lieutenant decide what he should do about the situation. He was not at all surprised when the lieutenant decided to do absolutely nothing but fold his arms on his chest and watch as the passengers entered the airplane from the whaleboats. As soon as the last passenger had entered, the pilot began to start the engines. Before all of them had started, the huge plane began to move. It disappeared around a point of Ford's Island, but the sound of its engines could still be heard. And then they changed pitch as the pilot went to takeoff power. When the Coronado next came into sight, it was airborne.
"Well, unless they threw Jake off when we couldn't see it, I guess they're on their way," Pickering observed. "Let's go, George."
He looked at the J.G.
"Good morning, Lieutenant."
"Good morning, sir,"
the lieutenant said. Pickering slipped behind the wheel and drove back toward the passenger terminal. As they approached, another Navy officer appeared, this one in whites. He stood in the middle of the road and raised both arms.
"Uh-oh," Hart said softly. "Another one."
Pickering slowed the car, and when he reached the Navy officer, stopped. Hart saw that the officer, who now saluted, was a commander, and that dangling from the shoulder of his white uniform was the silver cord of an aide to a flag officer.
"Good morning, sir. You are General Pickering, sir?"
"That's right. What can I do for you, Commander?"
"Admiral Nibbets's compliments, sir. The Admiral would be most grateful if you would speak with him, sir. There's a telephone inside."
"Certainly, I'll park the car."
Admiral Chester W. Nimitz was Commander-in-Chief, Pacific. Hart followed Pickering back into the passenger terminal where the aide waited, holding open the door to an office.
"This way, please, General," the aide said, and then made it quite plain with the expression on his face that Hart should remain outside.
Hart ignored him. He was under orders to go everywhere that General Pickering went, except, Colonel Rickaby had said, into a stall in a head, in which case he was supposed to wait where he could keep an eye on the door. The aide dialed a number from memory.
"Admiral," he said, "Commander Ussery, would you please inform SyncPAC I have General Pickering on the line?"
He handed Pickering the telephone.
"Nimitz."
"Pickering, sir. You wish to speak to me, sir?"
"How's your health, Pickering?"
"I'm very well, thank you, sir."
"I didn't expect to see you back here so soon."
"I didn't expect to be back so soon, sir."
"I appreciate the film you sent me."
"I thought you would be interested, sir."
"What's your schedule, Pickering?"
"I'm on the 1500 plane to Brisbane, sir."
"Could you fit an hour or so for me into your schedule?"
"I'm at your disposal, Admiral."
"I think it would be best if you didn't come here. Are you free for lunch?"
"Yes, sir."
"Somewhere private. Do you suppose we could meet at... could I invite myself for lunch at your place?"
"I'd be honored, sir."
noon. Would that be convenient?
Certainly, sir.
I'll make sure the Brisbane plane doesn't leave without you. Thank you, General.
The phone went dead in Pickering's ear. Pickering looked at Sergeant Hart.
Shine your shoes, George. Sinkpack is coming to lunch at Muku Muku.
Aye, aye, sir.
Pickering looked at Commander Usery. Would you like me to draw you a map, Commander?
That won't be necessary, sir.
Well, then, I suppose we'll see you at Muku Muku at noon.
Yes, sir.
3. Muku Muku, Oahu, Territory of Hawaii. 11:50 hours, 16 October, 1942. The official vehicle of the Commander-in-Chief Pacific was a black 1941 Cadillac, Model 62. There was no starred flag officer's plate. Instead, a blue flag with four silver stars flew from a staff mounted on the right front fender. Sergeant George Hart was waiting for Sinkpack's arrival on the wide, shaded flagstone porch of the rambling house overlooking the Pacific. He started down the stairs the moment he saw the car approaching, intending to salute, then open the rear door, then stand to attention while Sinkpack got out, then to close the door after him and follow him up the stairs. By the time he reached the Cadillac, Sinkpack was already out of the car. Commander Usery and the driver, a portly chief petty officer, quickly followed him. Hart noticed that the chief had gotten no farther than the hood of the car before Sinkpack was walking toward him. Hart saluted. Sinkpack, a tall, silver-haired man in his 50s wearing a high-collared white uniform, returned the salute, smiling.
"Good afternoon, Sergeant," he said, without breaking stride. "Would you be good enough to find the commander and the chief something to eat and do what you can to keep them out of trouble?"
"Aye, aye, sir," Hart said, as Sinkpack walked past him and up the stairs.
Brigadier General Pickering came onto the porch and saluted.
"Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to Muku Muku."
Sinkpack returned the salute and then put out his hand.
"We gave ourselves an extra 10 minutes in case we got lost," Sinkpack said. "I've only been here twice before, and that was a long time ago."
"Well, I'm glad you didn't get lost, sir."
"You look well, Pickering," Sinkpack said. "Better than I would have expected."
"I'm fine, sir."
"The way I heard it, the President pulled you out of a hospital bed."
"No, sir, I was already out of the hospital."
The door to the house was opened by a silver-haired black man in a gray jacket.
"Welcome back to Muku Muku, Admiral," he said. "I'm Denny. Do you remember me, sir?" "Indeed I do. But I'm surprised and flattered that you remembered I've been here before," Sinkpack said.
"May 22nd, 1939, as the guest of Captain Renner, Admiral," the black man said. "I checked the guest book."
"I don't suppose I could steal you away from General Pickering, could I, Denny?" Sinkpack said.
"Thank you, sir, but no, thank you."
"Renner has the Pacific Princess now, doesn't he?" Sinkpack asked.
"It's the USS Miller G. Fillmore now," Pickering said. "I sold her to the Navy, which was wise enough to hire Renner away from me for the duration to skipper her."
"What can we offer the Admiral to drink?" Denny asked.
"Ugh, if I drink at lunch, I have a hard time staying awake in the afternoon," Sinkpack said. "Having said that, I think a light scotch would go down nicely, thank you very much."
"We're set for lunch on the terrace," Denny said. "If you'll follow me, please."
He led the way through the luxuriously furnished house to the terrace, on the seaward side of the house. Sinkpack walked to the edge of the terrace and looked down the steep, lush slope. At its end, 500 yards away, large waves crashed onto a wide, white sand beach.
"I've never been here in the daytime before," he said. "I missed that. It's beautiful."
"Yes, it is," Pickering agreed.
"It makes the very idea of war seem all that much more obscene, doesn't it?" Sinkpack asked.
"Yes, sir, it does," Pickering replied.
Sinkpack met Pickering's eyes.
"Are we going to lose Guadalcanal, Pickering?" he asked. "Can Vandegrift hang on?"
Pickering was relieved when Denny appeared with the drinks. It at least delayed his having to answer a question he felt wholly inadequate to answer.
whether or not Major General Archer A. Vandegrift's 1st Marine Division was going to be torn from its tenuous toehold on Guadalcanal.
"Very nice,"
Sinkpack said, sipping his drink.
"Famous grouse," Denny said. "Funny name for a whiskey, isn't it?"
"Leave the fixings, please, Denny," Pickering said. "And give me 10 minutes' notice when lunch will be ready."
10 minutes from when you tell me," Denny replied.
"Admiral?" Pickering said.
10 minutes from now would be fine, Denny,"
Sinkpack said. He waited until Denny had left them alone on the terrace and then looked at Pickering again.
"Can he or can't he? A good deal depends on that."
"Admiral, with respect, I am in no way qualified to offer an opinion about something like that." Sinkpack nodded his head.
"I had a radio early today from Admiral Gormley," he said.
Vice Admiral Robert L. Gormley, USN, was Commander South Pacific and Senior Naval Commander for the Guadalcanal operation.
In it, he used the phrase, "totally inadequate vis-a-vis the forces available to him to resist a major Japanese attack." I think that's going overboard, but I would like to know what Vandegrift really thinks.
"General Vandegrift is a superb officer," Pickering said.
"The feeling around here is that General MacArthur is not doing all he can with regard to reinforcing Vandegrift."
"If that is your perception, sir," Pickering heard himself say, "I'm truly sorry."
"You don't perceive that to be the case?"
"Oh, to hell with it. He asked me, I'll tell him."
"I would suggest that there are people around General MacArthur who believe Sinkpack isn't doing all it can, Admiral." "You believe that?"
"I'm in no position to make any judgment whatever, sir."
"Right about now, your Major, what was his name?
Banning, sir."
"Banning is presumably briefing Secretary Knox, which carries with it the unpleasant connotation that he does not trust the reports being sent to him by me."
"I think he wants all the information he can lay his hands on, sir."
"Do you think it's likely that Secretary Knox will go to the President with the information Banning carried with him?"
"Yes, I do," Pickering replied.
"Do you think General MacArthur shares the opinion of those around him that we're not doing everything we can?"
"No, sir, I do not."
"When you see General MacArthur, will you give him my personal assurance that I am doing everything I can?"
"I will, sir, but I don't think it's necessary."
"And assure him that I have absolute faith that he's doing the same thing?"
"Yes, sir."
"I don't suppose you'd be willing or are free to tell me the nature of your current mission to SWPO,
Southwest Pacific Ocean Area." Pickering exhaled audibly. "On one hand, it's none of your business, Sinkpack or not. But on the other, you are Sinkpack." "General MacArthur, for whatever reasons, has not chosen to receive the emissaries of Wild Bill Donovan."
"General Donovan, of the Office of Strategic Services?"
"Yes, sir. General Donovan and the President are old friends. He has complained to the President, and the President has sent me to extol the virtues of the OSS to General MacArthur."
"Do you think you'll succeed?"
"General MacArthur rarely changes his mind. He told me that he doesn't think the good the OSS can do for him is worth what the OSS will cost him."
"Have you ever wondered, Pickering, why the President, or General Marshall, doesn't simply order Douglas MacArthur to do what he's told to do vis-a-vis the OSS?"
General George Catlett Marshall was U.S. Army Chief of Staff. "I'd heard there was bad blood between Marshall and MacArthur."
"When MacArthur was Chief of Staff, he wrote an efficiency report on Marshall, who was then commanding the infantry school at Fort Benning, stating he was not qualified to command anything larger than a regiment."
"I hadn't heard that, sir."
"There's bad blood between them, all right. But that's not the reason I'm talking about. Marshall put a knife in MacArthur's back after he left the Philippines. MacArthur left under the impression he was simply moving his flag and that the Philippines would remain under his command.
but the minute he boarded that PT boat, the Army started dealing directly with General Skinny Wainwright, in effect, taking him out from under MacArthur's command.
I'd heard that story, sir. From El Supremo himself. By admitting that, am I violating his confidence?
There was a brigadier general on Mindanao with 30,000 effectives, a fellow named Sharp. They had food and rations, munitions, and they weren't in the pitiable state of the troops on Bataan. When Bataan fell, and then a month later, Corregidor, the Japanese forced Wainwright to order Sharp on Mindanao to surrender. Sharp obeyed Wainwright's order. MacArthur feels, with some justification, that if he had retained command of the Philippines, that wouldn't have happened. He told me it was his plan to use Sharp's people and materiel to continue the war, either conventionally or as guerrillas. If he had retained command of the Philippines, he feels, Sharp wouldn't have had to surrender until he at least got a guerrilla operation off the ground and running. And now, they want to send somebody not under MacArthur's command in to start guerrilla operations? You have your work cut out for you, Pickering, to talk Douglas MacArthur into agreeing to that.
What's the difference who would run it, so long as it's hurting the Japanese?
Sinkpak looked at Pickering and smiled.
Of all people, Pickering, I would have thought that you would be aware of the effect of the egos of very senior officers on warfare. And actually, it's a moot point. The surrenders have taken place. Whatever materiel could have been used by a guerrilla operation has either been destroyed or captured, and there's simply no way to get any into the Philippines.
What did the Russian partisans do for supplies? Pickering asked.
Getting supplies across an enemy's lines is much easier than trying to ship them across deep water, Nimitz said.
Luncheon, gentlemen, Denny called from the far end of the terrace, is served.
4. The Foster Lafayette Hotel, Washington, D.C., 0005 hours, 17 October, 1942. Major Edward J. Banning, USMC, a tall, well-built 36-year-old, fresh from a shower and wearing only a towel, sat on the bed and stared at the telephone. After a full 30 seconds, he reached for it. He gave the operator a number in New York City from memory. He thought, as he counted the rings to 6, torn between disappointment and relief.
Maybe she's not home, away for the weekend or something. Or maybe she's got a heavy tape. Why not?
A woman's voice came on the line, her hello expressing a mixture of annoyance and concern.
Oh, God, I woke her up.
Carolyn!
Why did I make that a question? God knows I recognized her voice.
Oh, my God! Ed!
Did I wake you?
Where are you?
Washington.
Since when?
Since about 9 o'clock.
This morning?
Tonight.
I will give you the benefit of the doubt and believe this is the first chance you've had to call me.
It really was, he said. They just left.
They being?
2 bare-breasted girls in grass skirts and a jazz quartet.
In other words, you don't want to tell me.
Colonel Rickaby, Captain Sessions, some other people.
I purposely did not tell her the others were Senator Fowler and the administrative assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. Was that because of some noble concern with security? Or because I am just too tired to get into an explanation?
Where are you?
At the Foster Lafayette.
Very nice.
The Foster Lafayette was one of Washington's most prestigious and inarguably one of its most expensive hotels.
You know why I'm here, Carolyn, he said.
Brigadier General Fleming Pickering, USMCR, was married to the only child of Andrew Foster, who owned the Foster Lafayette and 42 other hotels. Foster had turned over to Pickering a Foster Lafayette suite for the duration, and Pickering had left standing orders that the suite be used by the officers on his staff when he wasn't actually using it himself.
He's in the Pacific, isn't he? Is anyone else there with you?
Christ, Carolyn, I don't think that's such a good idea, Banning said.
If the bare-breasted girls in the grass skirts come back, tell them you've made other plans.
She hung up. Banning stared for a moment at the dead phone in his hand and then put it in its cradle. Jesus Christ, he said, smiling. The telephone rang. He grabbed it. Major Banning.
I forgot to tell you something. Welcome home, and I love you.
You're something, he said, laughing.
With just a little bit of luck, I can catch the 105 milk train.
She hung up again. He put the phone back in its cradle again, swung his feet up on the bed, and lowered his head onto the pillow. He was almost instantly asleep. 5. The Foster Lafayette Hotel, Washington, D.C. 0805 hours, 17 October 1942. When the telephone rang, Carolyn Spencer Howell, a tall, willowy 32-year-old who wore her shoulder-length hair parted in the middle, woke immediately. She glanced at the man in bed beside her with a sudden tenderness that made her want to cry, and then smiled, anticipating the look on his face when the telephone's ringing finally woke him up. He slept on, oblivious to the sound. Finally, she pushed him, at first gently and then quite hard. His only response was to grunt and roll over. I never really believed that cutting hair was what Delilah did to Samson, she said aloud, and then made a final attempt to wake him. She held his nostrils shut. His response was to swat at whatever had landed on his face with his hand. The force of the swat was frightening. That was not a good idea, she said, then shrugged and reached for the telephone. Hello? She looked down at Ed's wristwatch on the bedside table. It was 8:05. She had been with him not quite 4 hours. Should I be ashamed of myself for taking advantage of an exhausted man? He didn't seem to mind. But neither was there any of that post-coital cuddling of fame and legend. He was sound asleep while I was still quivering.
Who is this?
A somewhat impatient male voice demanded. Who are you? Carolyn responded.
My name is Rickaby. I was trying to reach Major Edward Banning.
He's in the shower, Colonel Rickaby. May I take a message?
I'd hope to see him. I'm downstairs.
Why don't you give him 5 minutes and then come up?
Thank you,
Rickaby said, and hung up. She hung the telephone up and then really tried to wake Ed. Tickling the inside of his feet, at some risk, finally worked. After thrashing his legs angrily, he suddenly sat up, fully awake. What the hell are you doing? Your Colonel Rickaby is on his way up, Carolyn said. Christ! You talked to him? You wouldn't wake up, she said. I wonder what the hell he wants, Banning asked rhetorically and stepped out of bed. He headed directly for the bathroom. Carolyn picked up the telephone. Room service, please, she told the operator, and then ordered coffee and breakfast rolls for 3. Ed came out of the bedroom as she was fastening her brassiere. Jesus, you're beautiful, he said. I ordered coffee and rolls, she said. Would you like me to take a walk around the block or what? No, he said. Don't be silly. You stay. I'm not being silly. Is this going to be awkward for you? Don't be silly, he repeated, making a joke of it. I'm a Marine, aren't I? In other words, yes, it is going to be embarrassing for you. But you are either the consummate gentleman, or you love me too much. Maybe both, to consciously hurt my feelings. Whichever, thank you, my darling. Almost precisely 5 minutes later, the door chimes of Suite 802 sounded. Banning, by then dressed in a khaki shirt and green woolen uniform trousers, opened it to a tall, slight, pale-skinned, unhealthy-looking man in an ill-fitting suit. He was not what Carolyn expected. Ed was close-mouthed about what he did in the Marine Corps. Even though she told herself she understood the necessity for tight lips, this frustrated Carolyn. But she knew that Ed was in intelligence, even if she didn't know precisely what that meant, and that his immediate superior was Colonel F. L. Rickaby, whom he had once described as the best intelligence officer in the business. She had expected someone looking like Clark Gable in a Marine uniform, or maybe an American version of David Niven in a splendidly tailored suit, not this bland, pale man in a suit that looked like a gift from the Salvation Army.
Good morning, sir, Banning said. I was in the shower.
So I understand, Rickaby said.
He looked at Carolyn.
Honey,
Banning said, this is my boss, Colonel Rickaby. Colonel, my... Mrs. Carolyn Howell.
How do you do, Mrs. Howell?
How do you do? Carolyn replied, offering her hand. Rickaby's hand was, as she thought it might be, cold. Carolyn Spencer Howell was, in the flesh, very much as Rickaby thought she would be. He knew a good deal about her. He was a good intelligence officer. When Banning first became involved with her, Rickaby asked the FBI for a report on her, and the FBI's New York field office turned the investigation over to the Army's Counterintelligence Corps, a move that annoyed Rickaby, although he could not fault the thorough, professional job the CIC did on her. Carolyn Spencer Howell came from a respected, upper-middle-class family. Shortly after graduating cum laude from Sarah Lawrence, where she was apolitical, she married James Stevens Howell, an investment banker 10 years her senior. Mr. Howell's interest in younger women apparently did not diminish with marriage, and after nearly a decade of marriage, Mrs. Howell caught her husband in bed with a lady not far over the age of legal consent. As a result of encouragement by his employers to be generous in the divorce settlement, philandering vice presidents do not do much for the image of investment banking, Mrs. Howell became a rather wealthy woman. She took employment in the New York Public Library, more for something to do than the need of income, and there she met Major Ed Banning and took him into her bed. So far as the CIC was able to determine, Banning was the only man to ever spend the night in Mrs. Howell's apartment. And Banning, meanwhile, was honest with her, telling her up front that there was a Mrs. Edward Banning, whom he had last seen standing on a quay in Shanghai, and whose present whereabouts were not known. For Rickaby's purposes, Mrs. Howell was ideal for Banning. So long as he was, in his way, faithful to her, which seemed to be the case, he was unlikely to go off the deep end with a dangerous floozy, or even, conceivably, with an enemy agent. There was talk around, which Rickaby believed, that Ambassador Kennedy's son, the second one, John, had been sent to the Pacific after becoming entirely too friendly with a redhead who had ties with the wrong governments.
"I'm really very sorry to intrude," Rickaby said, meaning it, "and I wouldn't have come if it wasn't necessary. But the thing is, Mrs. Howell, I need about 30 minutes of Ed's time now, and about that much time at 10:30. I was just telling Ed that I was going to take a walk around," Carolyn said. "Have a look at the White House, maybe."
"It's raining," Rickaby said. "Walking may not be such a good idea, but if you could read the newspaper over a cup of coffee in the lobby..."
"My pleasure," Carolyn said. She smiled and left.
Rickaby waited until the door closed after her. "Houghton called," he said. "There's a special channel from Brisbane. He's going to bring it by the office."
Captain David Houghton, USN, was administrative assistant to Navy Secretary Frank Knox. A special channel was a message encrypted in a special code whose use was limited to the most senior members of the military and naval hierarchy, or more junior officers, for example, Colonel Rickaby and Brigadier General Pickering, whose immediate superiors were at the top of the hierarchy. Since Pickering was in Brisbane, the special channel was almost certainly from him. The only other person authorized access to the special channel in Brisbane was General Douglas MacArthur, who was the Supreme Commander, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area. It was unlikely that MacArthur would be sending messages to a lowly Marine colonel.
"Yes, sir."
"I thought you had better be there in case something needs clarification."
"Yes, sir."
"And it's possible that Houghton may want to talk about the Mongolian operation. If that's the case, I thought it would be better if you were up to date on it, changes, etc., since you left."
"Yes, sir."
"As soon as we're finished with Houghton, you're finished. Take the week I mentioned last night."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Do you think you could rustle up some coffee, Ed?"
The door chimes sounded. Banning opened the door to admit the waiter with the coffee Carolyn had ordered from room service.
"Your wish, sir," Banning said, chuckling, "is my command. I trust the colonel will pardon the delay."
6. Temporary Building T-2032, The Mall, Washington, D.C. 10:45 hours, 17 October, 1942. Captain David W. Houghton,
U.S. Naval Academy 22, a tall, slim, intelligent-looking naval officer, had called for a Navy car to take him to the mall where a large collection of temporary frame buildings built to house the swollen Washington bureaucracy during World War I were now occupied by the swollen and still swelling bureaucracy considered necessary to wage World War II. A 1941 Packard Clipper, painted navy gray with enlisted chauffeur, was immediately provided. This was not in deference to Captain Houghton's rank. It was said there were enough captains and admirals in Washington to fully man all the enlisted billets provided for on a battleship, but to the rank of his boss. Captain Houghton, who would have much preferred to be at sea as a lieutenant commander in command of a destroyer, as he had once been, was administrative assistant to the Secretary of the Navy, the Honorable Frank Knox. There were, of course, official automobiles assigned to the office of the Secretary of the Navy, including two limousines. One of these was at the moment in use by Secretary Knox, and the second was in the Cadillac dealership having a bad clutch repaired. There were also two 1942 Plymouth sedans painted navy gray. Chief Petty Officer Stanley Hansen, USN, Houghton's chief assistant, regarded one of these as his personal vehicle, and Houghton was reluctant to challenge the chief's perquisites. And he was reluctant to use the second Plymouth because he regarded it as a necessary spare. The secretary's limousine, or Chief Hansen's Plymouth, might collapse somewhere. And finally, he had requested a car from the motor pool for an admittedly petty, selfish reason. It had rained hard all day, and he thought it was unlikely to stop. He correctly suspected that the motor pool would dispatch a car much like the Packard that was, in fact, sent. A large car, reserved for admirals, and consequently equipped, fore and aft, with a holder for the starred plates admirals were entitled to affix to their automobiles. When an admiral was not actually in his car, the holder was covered. The shore patrol, which patrolled the area of the mall where Houghton was headed, would, he thought, be somewhat reluctant to challenge an illegally parked Packard with a flag officer's plate holder on it, even if the admiral's stars were covered. He could thus tell the driver to park right in front of temporary building T-2032, where he had business to transact with the Marine Corps Office of Management Analysis. This would spare him a long walk in the rain to and from the parking lot where lowly captains were supposed to park. The Packard pulled to the curb before one of the many identical two-story frame buildings, and the driver started to get out to open Houghton's door. "Stay in the car, son," Houghton ordered. Opened the door himself, and a heavy black Navy-issue briefcase in his left hand ran through the rain down a short concrete path to the building and stepped inside a vestibule. There was a sign reading, "Absolutely no admittance," on the door to the stairway of the two-floor frame building. Houghton pushed it open and stepped inside. Inside, there was a wall of pierced steel planking, interlocking sections of steel, perforated to permit the passage of water designed for the hasty construction of temporary aircraft runways, it was quickly adopted for a host of other purposes. A door of the same material, closed, and a window, open, were cut into the wall. Through the window, Houghton could see a Marine sergeant armed with a Colt Model 1911 A1-45 ACP pistol in a shoulder holster, sitting at a desk in his khaki shirt. His blouse hung from a hanger hooked into the pierced steel netting wall. Hanging beside his blouse was a Winchester Model 1897 12-gauge trench gun. The pierced steel wall and the armed guard were necessary because the Marine Corps Office of Management Analysis had nothing whatever to do with either management or analysis. What the Office of Management Analysis did was clandestine intelligence and special clandestine operations. The sergeant saw him, recognized him, and stood up.
"Good morning, sir," he said. "I know the colonel expects you."
Houghton held out to him a photo identification card.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir,"
the sergeant said, and pushed a clipboard through the window opening in the pierced steel planking. Houghton wrote his name, the time, and Colonel Rickaby in the 2C blank on the form on the clipboard and pushed it back. Colonel F. L. Rickaby was Deputy Chief of the Office of Management Analysis.
Thank you, sir, the sergeant said, and then pressed a hidden button. When he heard the buzzing of a solenoid, Houghton pushed open the door in the metal wall. He walked through a second interior door, which gave access to a stairway. He waited for a second buzz of a solenoid, then pushed the door open and started to climb the stairs. Behind him, he heard the sergeant, apparently on a telephone, say, Colonel, Captain Houghton is on deck. Houghton went up the wooden stairs two at a time. Beyond the door at the top of the stairs was another pierced steel wall. Beside it was a doorbell button. As Houghton reached to push the button, the door opened. Good morning, sir, Major Ed Banning said. When he saw Banning, Houghton was always uncomfortably reminded of his own non-combatant role in the war. On Banning's tunic were half a dozen ribbons, including one whose miniature oak leaf cluster represented the second award of the Purple Heart for wounds received in combat. The ribbon representing service in the Pacific Theater of Operations was further adorned with a small black star, indicating that the wearer had not only been in the Pacific, but had participated in a battle. In Banning's case, this was the Battle of the Philippines. Houghton had learned, not from Banning, but from Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, who had been there, that Banning took shrapnel from Japanese artillery during the initial Japanese landings. Left behind when American forces retreated and hiding out behind the enemy lines, he came under American artillery fire whose concussion blinded him. He was ultimately led through the enemy lines to a hospital and finally to the hospital on Fortress Corregidor. From there, he was evacuated with other blinded men by submarine. His sight inexplicably returned while he was on the sub. How are you, Banning?
Very well, thank you, sir. I guess we heard from the boss?
Houghton held up the briefcase, which was attached to his wrist by a steel cable and half a handcuff. Then he walked through the pierced steel planking door and down a narrow corridor to the end, which held the offices of the chief, USMC Office of Management Analysis, and his deputy. The door was opened by Colonel Rickaby, who had changed into a uniform after his breakfast meeting with Banning at the Foster Lafayette. But even in uniform, with the silver eagles of a colonel pinned to his collar points, and even wearing a 1911 A145 ACP automatic in a shoulder holster, Colonel F.L. Rickaby, USMC, did not look much like a professional warrior.
Hello, David. How are you?
Rickaby said, offering his hand. Houghton wondered if Rickaby really thought the 45 was necessary, or whether he was wearing it to set an example for the others. It seemed highly unlikely that anyone would launch an assault against the Office of Management Analysis, even with its bulging files of top-secret material. And even if that happened, it seemed likely that the pierced steel doors and the sergeants with their 12-gauge riot guns would at least slow them down enough so that reinforcements could be called up.
Good to see you, Fritz, Houghton said. Little wet outside. Would a cup of coffee be welcome, or something stronger? Coffee, please.
Banning turned and went down the corridor, obviously in search of coffee. Houghton found the key to his handcuff and with some difficulty managed to detach himself from the briefcase. Then he worked the combination lock of the briefcase and took from it a manila folder on which was stamped in inch-high red letters, Top Secret. He handed it to Rickaby as Banning returned, carrying three steaming china mugs by their handles.
General Pickering has been heard from, Houghton said, handing the file to Rickaby.
10 days before, Pickering had left his hospital bed, prematurely, Houghton thought, to undertake a personal mission for the president. Colonel Donovan, the head of OSS, had complained to the president that General Douglas MacArthur had flatly refused to even talk to the man Donovan had sent to run the OSS operation in the Pacific. And Roosevelt had decided that if anyone could solicit MacArthur's cooperation, it was Brigadier General Fleming W. Pickering. The documents in the top secret folder Houghton had brought to Rickaby were the first word anyone had heard from Pickering since he had flown back to the Far East. Rickaby slumped back in his chair and started to read the first of the two messages. Top secret. Eyes only. The Secretary of the Navy. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. To Sec Nave. Brisbane, Australia. Saturday, 17 October 1942. Dear Frank, I arrived here without incident from Pearl Harbor.
Presumably, Major Ed Banning is by now in Washington, and you have had a chance to hear what he had to say and to have had a look at the photographs and film. Within an hour of what I thought was my unheralded arrival, I was summoned to a private, really private, only El Supremo and me, luncheon. He also had a skewered idea why I was sent here. He thought I was supposed to make peace between him and Admiral Nimitz. He assured me that he and Nimitz are great pals, which I think, after talking with Nimitz at Pearl Harbor, is almost true. When I brought up Donovan's OSS people, a wall came down. He tells me he has no intention of letting Donovan get his camel's nose under the tent, and volunteered that Nimitz feels the same way. I also suspect this is true. I will keep trying, of course, both because I consider myself under orders to do so, and because I think that McKay is wrong, and Donovan's people would be very useful, but I don't think I will be successful. The best information here, which I presume you will also have seen by now, is that the Japanese will launch their attack tomorrow. Admiral Gormley sent two radios, 16 and 17 October, saying his forces are totally inadequate to resist a major Japanese attack and making what seems to me unreasonable demands on available naval and aviation resources. I detected a certain lack of confidence in him on McKay's part. I have no opinion and certainly would make no recommendations vis-a-vis Gormley if I had one, but thought I should pass this on. A problem here, which will certainly grow, is in the junior, very junior, rank of Lieutenant Han Song-do, the Army cryptographer analyst, who a horde of Army and Marine colonels and Navy captains, who aren't doing anything nearly so important, think of as a first lieutenant. Is there anything you can do to have the Army promote him? The same is true, to a slightly lesser degree, of Lieutenant John Moore. But Moore, at least, he is on the books as my aide-de-camp, can hide behind my skirts. As far as anyone but McKay and Willoughby know, Han is just one more code machine lieutenant working in the aptly named dungeon in McKay's headquarters basement. Finally, McKay firmly suggested that I decorate Lieutenant Joe Howard and Sergeant Stephen Koffler, who we took off Buka. God knows they deserve a medal for what they did. They met me at the airplane, and they look like those photographs in Life magazine of starving Russian prisoners on the Eastern Front. But I don't know how to go about this. Please advise. More soon. Best regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General USMCR. Top Secret. Houghton watched Rickaby's face as he very carefully read the radio teletype message and then handed it to Banning. Houghton thought, not unpleasantly, but simply recognizing the facts.
Technically, giving that to Banning to read is a security violation. No matter what kind of a security clearance Banning has, that message, both of these messages, are eyes only, sec nave, and that means just what it says. If the secretary wants to give them to someone else, that's his business. The fact that the secretary told me to show both radios to Rickaby doesn't mean that Rickaby has any authority to show them to anyone else, even someone like Banning. On the other hand, A, if the secretary knew about it, he wouldn't say a word. He trusts Rickaby's judgment. B, Banning isn't just an ordinary Marine Corps major with an ordinary top-secret security clearance. He's cleared for magic, and if an officer is on the magic list, I can't think of any classified material to which he has not authorized access. And C, after Banning's brilliant, and that's the only word that fits, brilliant, briefing of the President, the Secretary of the Navy, and Senator Fowler on the Guadalcanal situation yesterday, he is one fair-haired boy. And then, while Rickaby was reading the second radio and Banning was absorbing the first, Houghton had another thought, a wild thought, only peripherally connected to the first. There are three people in this little room with magic clearances. In all of the world, counting even the cryptographic officers who make the decryptions and the analysts, there are only 42 people on that list as of yesterday. What is it they say? A secret is compromised the instant two people know about it. That's probably true. And magic is one hell of a secret. When you have a small but growing capability to read your enemy's most secret encrypted messages, the value to the war is literally beyond measure. And to protect that secret as much as possible, you severely limit the number of people authorized access to it. Some people obviously have to be on it. The President, Admiral Leahy, the President's Chief of Staff, the Secretary and his Army counterpart, the Secretary of War, Admiral Nimitz as SyncPak, General MacArthur as Supreme Commander Sweepo, and the underlings, those who broke and are breaking the codes in Hawaii, the analysts, the cryptographic officers who, using a special code, encrypt the decrypted messages for transmission to Washington and Brisbane, the cryptographic officers and analysts here and in Brisbane, and a very few others. MacArthur's G2 in Brisbane, Nimitz's intelligence officer in Pearl Harbor, and Captain David Houghton, Colonel F. L. Rickaby, and Major Edward F. Banning here. We three underlings have to be on the list because we can't do our jobs without knowing about it. And of course, Brigadier General Fleming Pickering for the same reason. When I read, when was that? A month ago? Two? About the security arrangements for the magic people in Hawaii, I thought it made sense not to permit them to leave SyncPak without an armed escort. The Japanese might not know about magic, but they almost certainly knew something highly classified was going on. On one level, the idea of the Japanese kidnapping naval officers in Hawaii to see what they knew seemed fantastic. But so did the idea of the Japanese launching an aerial attack on Pearl Harbor on 7 December. A lot of unthinkable things happen in war, and even more in intelligence. Nimitz was right to provide his magic people with that kind of security. It just made sense. It also made sense to provide Pickering, over his objections, with a Marine bodyguard, an ex-St. Louis police detective. And the brass, of course, were routinely protected. The only people on the magic list who are not protected are Rickaby, Banning, and me. God, is that why Rickaby is carrying that gun? Does Banning carry one? Banning, may I ask you a question? Banning looked up from the radio message.
Certainly, sir.
Everybody else around here is armed to the teeth except you? Houghton said, making it a question. Banning smiled, stood up, turned around, and hoisted the skirt of his tunic. A 1911 A145 Colt was in a skeleton holster in the small of his back.
In maintaining the hoary traditions of the Corps, Captain, Banning said as he sat down again, we of management analysis are always prepared to repel boarders.
Houghton laughed, somewhat nervously. My God, I'm right. The reason these two men don't have an armed bodyguard with them is that they consider themselves competent to protect themselves. But the point is, they do think there is a sufficient risk that going armed is necessary, even here in Washington. Does that mean I should get myself a pistol? Christ, I've never been able to hit the broadside of a barn from 10 feet with a 45.
Rickaby, who was not known for his genial personality or for his sense of humor, looked up from his radio and glared at both of them. A moment later, he finished reading his radio and handed it to Banning. Banning handed him the first radio message, and Rickaby handed it to Houghton, who replaced it in the top secret folder. Banning started to read the second radio from General Pickering. Top secret. Eyes only. Captain David Houghton, USN, Office of the Secretary of the Navy. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. For Colonel F. L. Rickaby, USMC, Office of Management Analysis. Brisbane, Australia, Saturday, 17 October, 1942. Dear Fritz, at lunch with McKay yesterday, he justified his snubbing of Donovan's people here by saying that he has a guerrilla operation up and running in the Philippines. At cocktails before dinner, earlier tonight, I tried to pump General Willoughby about this and got a very cold shoulder. He made it plain that any guerrilla activity going on there is insignificant. After dinner, I got with Lieutenant Colonel Philip Dupre. He is the officer